The Mental Health Association in Suffolk County offers free support groups for depression, bipolar disorder, OCD, and post-traumatic stress. Separate support groups are also open for relatives and friends. For schedule and location information, or to register for a group, call 631-226-3900.
Suffolk County Department of Health's Learn to Be Tobacco-Free program is offering free smoking cessation classes to be held at the Stony Brook Tech Center. Classes are at 6 p.m. and run semi-weekly from May 12th to July 7th. The Stony Brook Tech Center is located at 14 Research Way in Setauket. To register, call 631-444-4000.
It is exactly 6:02 on a Tuesday evening. That means it's time for Off the Wall.
Thank you.
Yes, yes. Good evening. It is Off the Wall. I am Kyle.
Wow. We're really here, aren't we?
We are here, and that is Emmanuel.
It is. Emmanuel, a rather low Emmanuel, according to all those meters. There, that's better. Yes, we're back. We're here. We're live. And we can prove it, too. It's, how can we prove it? It's Tuesday. Wait, that's not good enough. It's Tuesday. Okay, wait. Donald Trump is in the headlines. No, that's no good either. What else is, what can we say that's, that proves that we're here, that it's new, a new show, a live show, the first live show in over 5 weeks? I don't think anything can prove it, because it's all predictable.
Well, I always like the weather. It's a little bit pedestrian, you know, kind of boring, kind of a idle thing to comment about, but it is gray. It is rainy. And it's odd because you're to have May flowers around this time. Usually you have April showers, but
yes.
Here we are at the outset of May, and there is quite a bit of drizzle and gray, overcast skies.
That's true. They say April flowers bring May showers, so there you go.
So if you're right here,
Wait, I have that wrong too? Hold on, I'm getting corrected on everything. What's wrong with that? That's how the phrase goes.
That is, yeah, that's the common phrase. So anyway, we're here.
Those April showers? Okay, I always thought those April flowers bring May showers, but I guess that makes more sense, that the showers would bring the flowers, not the flowers. Why would the flowers bring the showers? I didn't think it through, I'm sorry. The weather doesn't prove that we're live either, because the weather here is all kinds of messed up. I mean, it could be cold one day, it could be hot another day, it could be 70 degrees in January and 40 degrees in May. You know, there's no way to prove it.
Okay. So, the National Enquirer is a major journalistic source.
Now, wait a minute.
That is
hold
where
on.
We find out about our
hold
president.
Hold on. The National Enquirer is a what now? A major
journalistic resource.
Okay, so you've just proven we're in a parallel universe. Or actually, not a perpendicular universe, because, wow, never in my entire life has the National Enquirer been thought seriously by anybody above the age of 3 to be a source of anything journalistic.
No, they could break something and ruin everything for your candidate.
Ruin.
Candidate.
So that's what happened. Okay, yeah, this is something that I guess we didn't see coming. And that is the revelation by the bastion of journalism, the National Enquirer, that Ted Cruz's dad was pals with JFK's assassin. Wow, I didn't see that one coming.
Yes, right before this act, there was apparently some meeting, some contact between these individuals, and it is being reported by the National Enquirer, and this is
a strategy session, Ted Cruz's
discredit in this fantastic election
season.
He's
somehow able to take something like that, where literally the day of the most crucial primary, being Indiana, the Enquirer and Donald Trump jump on this insane story that his dad was friends with the assassin of JFK, that of course being the U.S. government. No, I'm kidding. We all know who killed JFK, right? We saw the film. We know. But the point is, he can mess that up so much that he looks bad. He looks bad for defending his dad from being accused of being friends with Lee Harvey Oswald. So, wow. I just went on a tirade against Trump, and it just it wasn't very presidential.
Yeah, he took the bait, I guess. I guess he engaged in this, and it's now causing all kinds of questions and consternation, disintegration, and as we witness this, and I guess shake our collective heads and wonder where it will go next.
Yeah, well, where it will go next is quite likely at this point. I can't believe I'm saying this. Quite likely, Donald Trump being the presumptive candidate, the winner, because Indiana is a winner-take-all state. I've got a little thing here that I found on the internet that talks about the various numbers. There are 57 delegates up for grabs in Indiana, and it's winner-take-all. So that means if Donald Trump wins by one vote, he gets all 57. Now, if he gets 57, he's 81% of the way to the magic number, and that magic number being 1,237. So he made up 20 percentage points in 2 weeks in six contests. I'm sorry to say, New York was one of those places where he did phenomenally well. And we've been getting a lot of crap from people saying, how could you do this, New York? How could you help push Trump into... Look, you got to understand, this isn't New York voting for Trump. Trump is not going to win New York if he is the candidate in November. This was the Republican primary. Republicans are the ones that vote for Republicans. And these Republicans decided to vote for Trump. So blame them. If Democrats outnumbered Republicans 9-1, he still would have had the same result because it's a Republican primary. So they had two choices, or maybe three if you want to be technical about it. He's a lot closer to the nomination now. If he sweeps Indiana's delegates, which is quite possible given that the polls are showing him up by double digits, he'll be 85% of the way there. Clinton, by the way, is 91% of the way to the 2,383 Democratic delegates that she needs. So Trump needs just 42% of all remaining unallocated delegates. That's 42%. That's a minority. Now, if he sweeps all of Indiana's delegates, he will need just 36% with nine contests remaining. So June 7th is the day that Trump could clinch.
He has to do even progressive. I mean, he could do progressively worse and still clinch this crucial number, right? That's the gist of it.
He could do worse. Well, I mean, he can't
do
worse than
excessively
than 36%, but he's never done worse than 36. I don't think there's a single state where he got less than 30. Well, maybe there is, but the fact is, when he wins, he's winning by big numbers, well over 50%, and double-digit differences between the next person. So, he can't clinch before June 7th. It's not possible.
Right.
And
okay,
Nobody else, not Cruz, not Kasich, they cannot clinch ever. They are mathematically eliminated.
You hear this a lot. Yeah, it's technically not possible.
It's not possible. The only way they can become the Republican nominee is in a contested convention. A contested convention. I love the sound of that, a contested convention. But it's beginning to look less and less like they'll even have the chance to have a contested convention, because Trump will reach that number beforehand. They'll have a vote, the first vote of the convention. He'll reach that number. There's nothing they can do at that point. Nothing they can do by their own rules. They created this monster, and I love it. I think it's great. I say this all the time. I want Trump to be the nominee, because I've heard so many people say, oh my God, if Trump is the nominee, it's going to be the end of the Republican Party, and boy, does that sound good to me. Having Trump being the candidate from now until November, can you imagine the things that we're going to be hearing? Can you imagine the debates between him and whoever the Democratic nominee winds up being? Probably going to be Clinton, and if it is Clinton, boy, I hope she picks a good vice president. That's all I have to say, because what Bernie Sanders has done is really improved the dialogue so much. He's brought such an honest campaign to the foreground and talked about things that I never thought I'd live to see being talked about in the mainstream in a presidential election campaign. He's done that. He's done it with respect. He's a socialist, an admitted socialist, who's being taken seriously and not being condemned for that. We've grown up so much that we can have this conversation now. So he has done that, and all these people are enthused, especially young people. So in order to keep those people involved and part of the conversation, if Clinton wins the nomination, she has to make some kind of gesture to get those people in. And having somebody like Elizabeth Warren or even Bernie Sanders himself as a vice presidential candidate to run with her, that would be the statement. And that, can you imagine that ticket? The enthusiasm. It would be a landslide. I just hope she doesn't do something politically safe in her eyes, which I think would be politically stupid. But it wouldn't be the first time I'd be disappointed.
Yeah, her cabinet, her administration, the potential cabinet, and the assemblage of the beginnings of what would be the administration, I think, is critical. It's going to be very important for solidifying the base, the foundation of people that are active on the Democratic side, really to go up against this specter or spectacle that is the Republican side. So it will be interesting times ahead, and a wild, open, and ruckus, I believe, dialogue as these two sides sort of shore up and go against one another in the open sort of general political run-up here.
It's going to get ugly. It's going to get really mean and nasty. Did you see Cruz yesterday trying to talk to Trump supporters? I don't know if he was trying to win them over or just have a dialogue or try to understand how they think. And I think he quickly realized they don't think. They just yell out things and they're very boorish.
Right, right. That was an example of I think his technique, which is to basically engage with people who come to the events or challenge him in any way, instead of cursing them from the stage and asking security to whisk them away. He definitely tries to talk and reason a bit, and that was sort of the result. Some of these guys don't want to really engage at all. They would prefer to curse at him repeatedly, and that's the kind of example of those interactions that he's getting now.
And the thing is, those people are going to be around the entire campaign, and they're going to feel emboldened, and there'll be more of them. And it's going to really get nasty, and I'm aware of that. But I kind of like to confront these things head on, and not beat around the bush. There's a problem here. There's a big problem in this country, and we need to face that problem, and defeat that problem, because these people are just scary, you know. They were in Patchogue. We weren't. We were away, but they were in Patchogue, the whole Trump contingent. I wish I could have been there to offer some kind of, I guess, opposition to that. I can't imagine where it's going to go. I can't imagine how it got to this stage. We were laughing about this. When did we start with the whole Trump thing? When was the Trump machine in here? It seems like ages ago. And we thought the whole thing was a joke then. But here it is, the eve, literally the eve of the nomination, the actual nomination. It's like some kind of nightmare, some kind of science fiction nightmare. How did this happen? Well, it did. We don't quite understand it. We talk to people overseas quite a bit. They wonder what the hell we're doing. Don't know how it got to this stage, but it's endemic of a serious issue in this country that needs to be addressed. And hopefully this time the dialogue will be decisive, and we can move forward instead of falling backwards.
Yeah, the partisan political system has failed in a lot of ways. These deadlocks and inability to actually produce results, and even in the face of disagreement, or especially when we do disagree, I think has been a real disappointment, and I think it's going to get worse before it gets better.
Yeah, well, we'll find out tonight. Again, if he wins Indiana, it's pretty much locked up. And it's hard to believe that's gotten to this stage, but here we are. Now we have to face it, and I think it's better that we face it than just say, "Wow, we almost had to face it." And to be honest, I would not be enthused with Cruz at all. He scares me a little more only because I think he could get elected. And all these people are just ignorant. They deny things like climate change. They want to push things back to the 1950s, I guess, is and that's being nice. And we need to you know, cast away from that once and for all. Because I, for one, am sick of it, and I want to catch up to the rest of the world. You know, that would be nice. We've been traveling for the last 5 weeks. We've been in Canada for a couple of those weeks. And it's just so refreshing to go someplace else and to talk to people and have intelligent conversations and see how the rest of the world lives. You know, health insurance alone, one thing there, how easy it is for people in other parts of the world and how ridiculous it is for us here. You know, we've been over that many, many times, but it's something that that we really need to straighten out.
Right, or walking around and realizing that there aren't armed individuals just all around you, and that sort of byproduct of that being a bit of a sense that you're safe when you're in public, that people aren't potentially going to become enraged and act out with deadly weapons.
Mm-hmm.
Little things like that.
Yeah, it's true. We had many conversations with people in Canada who want to come to the United States, and a couple of them said, you know, I would go to the United States except for the guns. Literally, that is how they feel. They believe it is so violent here, so dangerous here, because so many people are armed, that they will not come to this country. And when we were on the train from Vancouver to Toronto, it was basically 4 days, mostly without any contact with the outside world, you know, a few bits of connectivity now and then, but most people really didn't want to be connected to the outside world. But I knew at some point when we did get reconnected, I'd hear some mass shooting back in the United States, and there were three of them when we got back, or when we got back into a major city. It's just so sad that this is how we are seen in the rest of the world. And for what? For what ridiculous purpose? Just so we can cling to some misguided perception of what the Founding Fathers wanted? And come on, people, grow up, you know? It's enough already. We have more important things to do than cling to our guns and make all kinds of angry vows. It's silly, it's stupid, it's outdated. Let's join the rest of the world and start planning things and doing things and progressing and not being suspicious and angry all the time. So we had a lot of fun throughout the entire kind of unplanned trip. We just sort of planned it as we went along. We wanted to take a train out west, and we wound up taking four trains out west.
Yes, we took the Amtrak system, but not the the northern route that we had taken in previous trips.
That's what goes through Minnesota, North Dakota, Idaho, things like that, from Chicago. When you plan these trips, what you can do is, and it's the same price or same number of points if you use their point system, you can say, I'd like to take this route instead. And we decided to take a route that encompassed four different trains.
Yeah, that was the beauty of the American system going in that direction, going west in the early part of the trip. And then we did spend several hours. We had some layovers and captured some of what that was about and recounted it. And then spent a little bit of time on the West Coast, exploring places like around Washington and downtown in Seattle. There's a lot of transportation building and infrastructure projects there that we wanted to visit and check up on, and so we did. We explored that system a lot and then went up to BC in British Columbia, the city of Victoria, as well as Vancouver.
Took the Clipper.
Yeah, it's a boat, a really fast boat. I think they have similar types of vessels here in the New York area. This one basically gets you up into BC to Victoria on Vancouver Island in roughly like 2.5 or 3 hours.
Yeah.
And you do a border crossing, and we spend a little bit of time there and then spend some time in Vancouver, basically taking a ferry from Vancouver Island to the city of Vancouver.
Most of this has been documented in the last few weeks of Off the Wall, but some of it hasn't, so we're filling in some of the holes of things that went on. We went from Victoria to Vancouver. That involved a bus and a ferry. Spent some time in Vancouver. We talked about the heroin addicts on the street and the liveliness of the city and various other. We didn't talk about the cannon that goes off every night. What is that, 9 o'clock at night in Vancouver, there's a cannon that fires? And it really, if you're not aware that's going to happen, it can really scare you.
Yeah, there's like it's like a thing that traditionally had been used to set your clock to, kind of like a tower bells or some kind of clock ringing striking at a certain hour in a city center. So that was neat. We witnessed some of that, like little quirky things about the various places we were visiting, and then saw quite a bit of Canada in the process. And again, more systems, more interesting payment methods and scheduling, figuring out older train systems and how they're working with new systems. A lot on that theme of terrestrial transportation and how it's changing. Well, we got a lot of ideas too for other trips and other places up in this other country that is so close, Canada. So that was really neat.
We want to go to Churchill. All right. Does anybody know what Churchill is? Anybody
been to Churchill, if you have a story about your time in Churchill, we'd like to hear about that, because that's one of the more north-south train routes, other than what is on the East Coast.
Churchill's all the way up. I think it's on top of Manitoba, and there's a train route that goes up there.
And it's on a lake. It's on one of the Great Lakes.
It's on a lake. And there are some interesting train routes on the VIA system. VIA being Canadian Rail, and there's a whole history there, too. I would go to the Wikipedia page, look up VIA Rail. You'll hear all about the different kinds of lines they used to have, what they have now, budget cutbacks they've had to deal with, rejuvenations, things like that. The train we took, which was our first real VIA experience, we had taken a train from Toronto to New York technically on VIA, but it was actually an Amtrak train. This was our first VIA Rail experience. They basically, the train we took, I think, was the longest train you can take in North America. It was four nights. We started on, I believe, a Tuesday night and wound up in Toronto on Saturday. And it was a train that was rebuilt from the 1950s. The cars, were made in 1954. And it just attracts all these amazing people from all over the world who want to experience this. You wind up having the most incredible conversations. We met people from New Jersey. We met people from Austria. We met people from Australia and, of course, from Canada. And they're all there for a reason. They're all there because they want to take this train. They don't want to fly. They don't want to rush. And you just wind up sharing so much and learning so much. It's the most incredible thing. I can't recommend it enough for people that that are open to it.
Yeah. Oh yeah, it's a cool journey. It's really really a neat way to travel, and it does attract all kinds of different people. And you realize it's so closely related to our history and the Canadian history, that the development and settling of both the countries were heavily reliant upon railroad, and that tradition continues on. That spirit of travel and networking, basically keeping communities connected.
Yeah, absolutely. We continued on to Toronto, and we visited our friends, the sled dogs that we transported last year.
Good. Yeah, I liked seeing the dogs. That was fun.
Great seeing the dogs. There's only 31 dogs now. There were 34 when we started. We lost Rocket,
Goblin,
Pumpkin.
Yeah.
Okay, so. Those three dogs, they were old dogs, but, you know, one of the dogs there now is 18 years old. He's a big dog, too.
Newtalk,
yeah, she, I'm sorry, you know, I can't tell the damn difference.
Well, maybe it's a he, I don't know.
A name like Newtalk, how are you supposed to know?
It's a bit wild, though. You really have to realize and appreciate that's quite an old age for a dog, but
yeah.
Really amazing to see them and see where they have made their new home and how everyone has adjusted, and we've got all kinds of good stories and updates on various situations there and what's going on with sledding in the future, and what possibilities there are with the weather and the seasons and so on. So we're still learning about that, and we've got a lot to go through. We caught up with the whole pack of them and walked around and
everyone. We
oh, yeah.
spent time with every one of them.
We did.
Especially Red. Red is a cool dog. Red is he's the only true husky of
well,
the bunch.
That's true. Yeah, Red Red is a Siberian.
Yes.
And all of the other dogs are Alaskan huskies. But a Siberian husky is the quintessential husky. And if you go by a certain color and coat patterns, they are the quintessential husky dog. But as we learned, the Alaskan huskies can have a variety of looks and coats and so on. So, but I really connected with Red. Red was very happy. I think a little bit nervous when we first got there. I think was a little bit relaxed after we got to spend some time with him, just because I guess he was in a transition where he was moving in.
Yeah, he's an indoor dog now. Most of the dogs stay outdoors. There's a small group that go indoors, and Red had just transitioned to that, but he was getting into altercations with some of the younger dogs there, so he was a bit trepidatious when we first saw him. But yeah, he really bonded with you.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time with him, and he followed me around. He's got a little perch in the sort of wood-covered wood pile outside, and has a couple different spots where he sits, and but does basically come inside now, and that's a new routine for him. But I think it's going to be good for him as he gets older, and really looked great as far as adjusting, and was really happy. Opened up as we got to play and catch up a little bit there.
I like Danny because he's all white dog. And very friendly. He's an indoor dog as well. I'm disappointed in Danny because he's been picking on Red. I don't like to hear things like that. And, of course, there's Maud. Maud is the coolest dog ever because she doesn't even seem like a dog. She kind of just sits on the couch and puts her paw on you and just tries to talk to you. She's on the verge of speech, I think. And she always starts the howls, too. You know, if you ever hear 31 dogs howling at once, that is something to behold. And she's always the one who starts that. But other than that, you just don't think of her as a dog. She's very intelligent and conversational.
She totally is. She's an incredible host and hostess, and definitely has so much personality, like all of the dogs there.
Mm-hmm.
Really showed us a good time, and we really had fun. Just taking it in and getting to know them that much better.
I like Storm. You know, you pet Storm, and Storm's another white dog who's inside, has a very short tail. If you pet him a few times, he starts growling, but in a happy growling way. But it's just kind of amazing how you can do that. There's Siren. He's an outdoor dog. Well, she's an outdoor dog, and she climbs the fence and stands on top of the fence. Really incredible. Every single one of them has personality. They're all amazing creatures. And we love visiting them. So we spent a couple of days there. Then we took another Via Rail train from close to Toronto up to Montreal, and spent a couple of days in Montreal, which is always fun.
I felt so at home. It was amazing. I don't know if it's the language or what it is, but I just got really comfortable. I started hearing French, and just something about Montreal I changed. It was a rough landing, you know. We were looking for this and that, and getting comfortable in the train system again. We bought the wrong rides when we were filling our wireless. What is it called? An Opus?
Yeah, I have it right here. The Opus card. We got an Opus card, which is an RFID, you know, a credit card looking thing. And we thought we were buying a ticket to the metro so that we could get to the place we were staying. Instead, we were buying a ticket to a local train, which had absolutely no value on the metro system. We found that out when we tried to get into the metro, and then we had to buy, I think it was for the best, because we bought a 3-day pass, and what that allowed us to do was just go anywhere we wanted to go at any time. And that really came in handy, because we went out later that night and wound up staying out after the metro closed, so we had to figure out our way back on night buses. And of course, we went the wrong way on the night buses and wound up all the way on the wrong side of town. But we were always safe because we could always get on with the card because it was a day pass.
Oh, it was so totally screwed up. We, at one point, were supposed to get directions. We were using some map app made by, I'll not mention the search engine company who runs it, but it was giving us terrible advice, or at least non-specific advice. And at one point, we were supposed to be in a bus terminal at some I think, the 15th stall or whatever, but there was no way we would have known there's scaffolding on everything and all kinds of construction going on.
The search engine, which shall remain unnamed, tells us to walk over and catch the bus. They don't feel it's necessary to mention, by the way, the bus is inside a building that you have to walk into as well, and then find out what stall the bus... You know, and we thought it was a bus stop, because anybody would think that, and we missed the bus because of that.
Yeah, I couldn't understand it, but we basically had to walk inside what was like a ground floor parking garage, but it was really a bus terminal, mm-hmm. and we had no idea because it was late, and there was no signage, and scaffolding, and construction everywhere. It was just a crazy, crazy, absurd example of... just the craziness, the uncertain stuff you'll be thrown when traveling. You can have everything planned out, but that one thing, that one detail will be totally throw you off. It'll be a curveball out of nowhere, and you'll have to really reset. You'll have to take a deep breath and. Well, I usually have to scream after I take the deep breath.
It's okay to scream every now and then. And,
I was exasperated and tired, and it was just not fun.
But you have to realize that it's going to work out. You'll figure it out, and there are just certain things that wind up happening sometimes. You're going to go the wrong way. You're going to get on the wrong bus. You're going to see something you weren't expecting to see. But you learn something in the process, and you get better at it. And we did get better at traveling around that city. I think we became masters after a while.
Yeah, I dare say. I think we are much better at getting on and off their system. No, I actually do feel a lot more comfortable about their system. It has its quirks. You mm-hmm. know, you have to be ready for what may be not working or working or be unclear, but it ultimately made sense in the end, and we were able to survive.
And we went the next day. We were wandering all over the place, too. And you said, I'd like to see McGill University, because that's in Montreal. So we took a metro over to McGill and started walking around, and we were on campus. And I happened to notice that they had an observatory building on campus. So we kind of headed in that direction. The campus is huge. Didn't know exactly where it was. Then I looked up on my phone if the observatory was open to the public ever, because it was such a beautiful day. It was the sky was so incredibly blue. It was clear, and I would have loved to have seen an observatory on a day like that. And I found out that they have, yes, indeed, they have once a week lectures and observatory viewings, and the next one was starting in 8 minutes. I mean, what are the odds? What are the odds of us being on a campus in a city where they have once a week a lecture followed by observatory viewing through a telescope on a day that the sky is so perfectly clear, and we just happen to be there 8 minutes from where it starts.
Yeah, that was a crazy, crazy coincidence, but I'm just so glad we were able to check it and go and make it. We were so familiar, I think, at that point, because the campus is open and nice, has decent maps, and there were a lot of people, a lot of activity. Just being there alone was amazing, and then finding out this public astronomy session goes on in the evenings regularly, I guess, at certain intervals. So we basically latched onto this lecture. We're able to just find a seat and get some details and remember some things we'd heard. We watched various programs, of Cosmos being one of them,
yes.
and we're familiar with some of the stories, but they went into some interesting detail, and it was a good lecture.
It was on comets.
Yes, yes,
all about
and
comets.
How they're like harbingers of doom throughout mm-hmm. history, and all of this sort of interesting background. And then we went out and waited in line to use a pretty neat telescope, which was a treat in and of itself. And we saw some things. I saw some things orbiting while we were standing in line.
This is amazing. You saw a satellite going over all the people who are waiting in line to look through the telescope. And we tried to get people's attention. I think we got one person's attention saying, hey, look, there's a satellite. No one else is aware of the satellite. It turned out to be, I think, a Russian rocket or something. Wow, you're always finding satellites in the sky.
I was just thinking to ask you to check
uh-huh.
to see if anything might be overhead while we're standing in line. And as I looked, I immediately just locked on and saw something orbiting, realizing, well, oh gosh, you know, I don't have to check. How about I just look and there is something. Now we can check what that was.
Kyle and his satellite vision.
I don't know what it was. It was just, I had, my ears must have been burning, so to speak, because as soon as I looked up, there was something right before me.
Well, we waited online for about 25 minutes or so, and then we were able to see Jupiter through a telescope in a way I had never seen Jupiter before. This was a really good telescope. You could see stripes on Jupiter. You could see four of its moons.
All
really,
four.
Really amazing. Well, there's a lot more than four, but four of the big ones.
All four of the major moons.
Mm-hmm.
Ganymede, Europa, Io, and Callisto.
Very good. I'm impressed.
Yeah.
I assume you're right, too.
From memory.
That's good. That's very good.
What else? What else did we do? So McGill was great. It was very cool. It's always good to go to a university when you're in a city, especially if it's a big part of the town.
Well, the
so
thing about
cool.
universities,
really cool.
and Stony Brook is no exception,
mm-hmm.
it's open.
Yeah.
It's open to the public. And it's just great to partake in the various things that are going on because it's all about learning. It's all about sharing. And that's the environment that I think we try to take with us and try to embrace whenever we're visiting foreign cities and even domestic cities. But after that, we got on a train very early the next morning to go back to New York. That was the train from, they call it the Adirondack.
You're right, yes. That's another Northeast Corridor line, so to speak. Or
actually, no, it's not the Northeast Corridor.
Part
Northeast
of it.
Corridor goes from Boston to D.C.
Oh, pardon me.
So this one is the slow-ass line.
Well, it's part of Metro North, right?
No, it's not. It might as well be.
Well, you see some Metro North trains.
Well, once you pass Poughkeepsie, yeah, you do.
Fine. Anyway, it's one of these East Coast trains.
It takes 10 hours to get from Montreal to New York, and it's a six-hour drive, so I don't get that.
All right. It was a real joy.
Yeah. Well, it's an Amtrak train, but it's nothing like the long-distance ones. But
after all the trains we'd been on, it was really kind of ho-hum, and we really got a lot of got a lot done. Don't get me wrong. I mean, we enjoyed the scenery and stuff, but I'd seen so many different train rides. It felt like a blink of an eye.
Mm-hmm.
When you spend several days on a train, a couple-hour train ride, you, I guess, take for granted. It's not as much of an event. I hope I wasn't getting too spoiled by all
this. No, well, think of what we did, though. Think of what we did. We wound up taking a train from, well, first of all, we took a train from here to Penn Station. A
right.
lot of people, that's a big deal, and it used to be a big deal for me. But then after Penn Station, we went down to Washington, D.C., then got on another train after spending some time in D.C. up to Chicago, then spent 6 hours walking around Chicago, got on another train to L.A., spent a couple of hours in L.A., and then took a train up to Seattle. And then after we got to Vancouver, we took a train all the way back to Toronto, then a train up to Montreal, then a train back down to New York, and then the Long Island Railroad back out here. Wow. I mean, that's a lot of training. You know, I've never done a circle like that, and I think that even beats the Trans-Siberian Railway, which I did.
Speaking of training, we also did some bicycling.
That's right. Yeah, you know, it's been nonstop activity. As soon as we got back, we basically had to get ready for Sunday's Five Borough bike ride.
The Five Borough.
Which, you know, it's the fourth time I've done it, the second time you've done it. The difference this time was, well, first of all, I felt like I was completely out of shape because I hadn't ridden since basically last year. So there was that. And also, it was pouring rain on Sunday. So that added some challenge to the mix.
I'm right there with you. I was feeling way, way behind as far as being fit and practiced, as it were, with the bicycle. But it's funny. You know, I'm not making a joke. You know, you don't forget. It comes right back to you. It's just like riding a bike. And however, the rain adds this huge layer of danger. And gosh, it was slippery. But we did it. We did amazing. You were doing amazing stuff out there. I almost got like pinched and, you know, run off the road by some of these people at various points. But our bikes were in great shape. I think we just put our noses down, partly because I think we got a good early start. We were in the first wave this time, but we stayed out of relative danger. avoided a lot of the slippery metal, like manholes and things like that, and just basically stayed low and kept pedaling on through what started out as very light rain and ended up being sort of a medium to hard sprinkle.
It's 40 miles, okay, and, you know, a lot of people are very impressed by that, and I'm amazed that they're impressed. I guess, you know, it is a lot, but when I see what other people do, it doesn't seem so impressive. But I guess when you compare it to people who don't ride bikes or who just don't ride that much,
right?
It is a lot. And having done it a few times, it you know, it doesn't seem like a whole big deal. But on the other hand, it's an accomplishment, and it's empowering as well. The way it works, you start in Lower Manhattan, usually around World Trade Center. You ride up 6th Avenue, which is an amazing ride. It's nice and flat. The street's closed to traffic, and you have basically thousands and thousands of people on bikes, all going at a very moderate pace, you know, not fast at all, very relaxing. All the way uptown, you see the streets going by. You see all the famous places. You pass by Radio City Music Hall, and before you know it, you're in Central Park, and then you're riding through Central Park, a couple of small hills, mostly downhill. Then you're in Harlem. Then you're making a right-hand turn. You're crossing into the Bronx only for a few minutes and coming right back into Manhattan, going down the FDR Drive to the Queensboro Bridge. And that's the first part that I always feel a little bit of trepidation about, because you see the Queensboro Bridge. You're going down the FDR Drive, and you see it up there in the distance. It's so high up, and you have to somehow pedal your way all the way up there. And I'm just thinking, I've been dreading this for weeks, literally. I'm thinking, how am I going to be able to do that? Where am I going to get the strength? And you make the turn onto First Avenue or past First Avenue, and then you start going up that ramp. And, you know, I got to admit, this time I was feeling, I don't think I can do this. I don't think I can make it. Then I started looking around me, and I saw other people basically pacing themselves, going slowly, you know, not exerting themselves too much.
Methodically, though. You just have to keep pedaling, you know, mm-hmm. one after the other.
Exactly. I thought the things you said about having to huff it a little bit, but, you know, not going too crazy, shifted into a lower gear and just kept pedaling and counting the lamppost and saying, okay, only a few more, and just calming down, basically, saying, all right, I'm going to make it. And inside of a few minutes, there I was at the top and ready to go down the Queensboro Bridge into Queens. And that was amazing. That was amazing because that's sort of like the first real hurdle. You wind up pedaling up to Astoria under the Triborough Bridge as a park. You hang out there. You rest a little bit. That's the halfway point. And then you pedal all the way down through Brooklyn. There's a couple of hills on the BQE, which are really kind of tough. But the final hurdle is the Verrazano Bridge. Oh, my God, that thing I have nightmares about. But, you know, the last couple of times I paced myself, I've gone nice and slowly. It's twice as long as the Queensboro Bridge, it feels like. But once you make it up there, you're done. You just basically cruise into Staten Island. There's a big park there. There's a party. But nobody stuck around for the party this time because it was raining. We all basically pedaled another 4 miles, which is nothing, in Staten Island, on fairly flat terrain to the Staten Island Ferry, and then we were done. Something like that is you know, you're pushing yourself, but you're actually feeling like $1 million when you're done. So right now, I don't feel like $1 million. Right now, I hurt in a lot of places, and I think you do too, Kyle.
Oh yeah, I'm still sore. I'm, you know, but it feels good. You just put your feet up. You have to maybe take a little bit of extra time, maybe stretch a couple times. Those kinds of things. Your body behaves differently, but it tells you what you want. You know, what you need to recover, and there is that recovery period. You have all these weird biochemical things going on, lactic acids and processes and that's part of the exercise. But you find that after a day or two, you come right back and feel, I think, energized. You like you have an accomplishment under your belt, and makes you want to do more of that.
Yeah, I feel more accomplished now than I have in a while, both because of our travels, what we've done, just basically hoofing it across the states and across Canada. And, you know, it's riding a train sounds easy, but when you have bags and you have to get from one place to another and you have to figure out transit systems and interact with all kinds of people and entities, it's a challenge. It's a real test for your patience and for your ability to adapt.
I can speak to that. Yeah, socializing. Uh-huh. That breaking the ice on the train, or whether it's just catching up or recounting some of these adventures, it is kind of, or what you're doing to people that you're maybe catching up with, it can be a bit exhausting sometimes, but it's worth it.
Yeah, to get back here and then to engage in that physical exercise as well.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
That adds to it, and now it's all catching up. I mean, I've been working pretty much the whole time, so have you. But there are still things that you can only do when you're here. So I've got a mountain of physical mail to go through and all kinds of things to catch up on. But you know what? I refuse to stress out about it. And this is something that I think a lot of people should try and emulate as well. For instance, for some reason, my bank is calling me 6 times a day. Because I looked at the 800 number that's calling. It's my bank. Well, maybe there's something wrong with my bank. I don't know. I'm going to deal with it when I get to it. It's going to take a couple of days for me to figure it out. But they're freaking out about something. I don't care. I'm not going to stress about it. There's all kinds of other crises that people are throwing my way, and I'll get to it when I get to it. You know, things aren't on fire. Whatever I have to do to work it out, I'll work it out. And if
slowly.
I owe you an email, you'll get it eventually. Everything's being taken care of, but it's no point stressing yourself too much.
Yes. Slowly and methodically, things will rebalance, and we'll be out and about with new adventures, for sure.
An update. I know a lot of people have been concerned about this. We talked about Europa League, and we have been remiss in not reporting where we are in the competition. As you know, we started the year with Southampton, and basically... we've been following whatever team wins in each match, and we got to the point where I believe it was Liverpool, and we followed Liverpool. We were in the quarterfinals? Were we in the quarterfinals? And Liverpool wound up defeating Manchester United. Is that what happened? Yeah, Liverpool beat Manchester United. We were following them for a little while. And then Liverpool wound up meeting Borussia Dortmund, and they played them twice in the quarterfinals, two legs, once at home, once away. And they wound up coming from behind in Liverpool, a very emotional game because it was the anniversary of this horrible disaster in Liverpool where 96 fans lost their lives. I think it was 1989. So there was that. They wound up winning the game, advancing to the semifinals. And now they are playing a team from Spain, Villarreal. They played one game so far. They lost 1-0 in the last seconds, and they have the second leg of that on Thursday, and the winner of that game goes to the final. And the final takes place in Basel, Switzerland, on May the 18th. And, you know, I just found out before we came in today that the Champions League, which plays their games on Tuesdays and Wednesdays, they basically decided one of the teams that's going to go to the final, and that's Atletico Madrid. You remember when we were in Madrid? The battle of the two Madrids, Real Madrid and Atletico Madrid, that could happen again because Real Madrid plays tomorrow. If they win, they go to the final. Atletico Madrid is already going to the final. And I hope they win because they lost last time. And that's the update.
It will be exciting, and we will keep everyone up to date and excited, as excited as we are about those events and other interesting games and news items.
Oh, and I suppose we should update people on the vote as well. From our browser is so old that it can't keep up with my clicks. Donald Trump is 54.2%. Ted Cruz, neck and neck, 32.6%. Yeah, that's how it is. OTW@2600.com is our email address if you have anything to say to us.
WUSB.FM is where you can catch the archive and the schedule.
Good night.
See ya. I could start to talk again. I could talk all night. My mind